It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Farm to Table Talk focuses on our food and how it's grown because people are curious. But I think it's only appropriate that we focus on wines and how they're grown and coming from the vineyard. And I think in an important way, both of them start with the soil. And my guest today pays as much attention to the soil and the terroir as anybody I know that's connected with the wine industry. And it's my pleasure to welcome Randall Graham to Farm to Table Talk. Randall?
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you know, you do such a great job. And many people know of you, of work you've done at Bonnie Doon Farms. But you have a reputation of being kind of an out-of-the-box thinker when it comes to wine. And you have a reputation that you put more attention on the soil and how it's grown and trying to go with what works in an area. And I'm not even doing justice to introduce you that way. But do you take exception to that, or do you feel that?
No, that's really what I aspire to do. I think that as you've described me, is a lot more aspirational than the current reality. I mean, you know, a lot of the wines we make currently under the current regime are made from purchased grapes, and there's only so much control you have over grapes that you buy. But if you grow the grapes yourself, you have complete control, and that's ultimately what I aspire to do.
We've been very successful in producing with grapes that you've purchased a number of wines that have become recognized. And I used to live in the Santa Cruz area, and we'd go up to your tasting room, and I love your wines. I find they're a little harder to find now than what they were when I was in Santa Cruz, and I'm sure you can give me some suggestions on how we can find it. But let's jump ahead to trying to control the land and the plants and, you know, where you're growing and how you're growing before we ever get to the bottle. Well, explain that. You mentioned that you wanted to be able to have more influence on that. So you've found land. Could you explain where you found it and why you decided to make that the spot you're going to put your flag in the ground?
Sure. Well, it turns out that the ultimate quality of wine is enormously dependent on the quality of grapes that you begin with. There's not that much winemaking magic that can be done. There's sort of more winemaking mistakes that can be done. But so sort of the upper limits of real fine quality wine, it's truly made in the vineyard. And it's a bit of a cliche, but it's 100% true that wine is made in the vineyard. So if you take enormous pains in the vineyard, it's not just the pains, but it's the inherent qualities of the vineyard itself. So it's beginning with the right location and then, of course, farming it correctly. And if you do those things properly, if you have the good luck to start with a great vineyard, the winemaking itself becomes pretty trivial and very simplified. So the take-home lesson, of course, is start with the right place. Of course, this is, as we say, easier said than done. what is the right place? What does it mean to be the right place? You know, and so right place means a couple things. One, sort of the inherent potential of the soil to grow great grapes. And then secondly, the thoughtfulness of the pairing of what is being grown with where it's being grown. So in other words, you can start with an interesting site in, say, Sacramento, but planting Pinot Noir there is probably not going to be the world's greatest idea. So you want to make sure that the grapes you're growing are congruent to the site where you're growing it. And then the other big thing that's super important is maintaining the health of the soil, the vitality of the soil, the microbiome of the soil. And there are a lot of practices that seem to encourage a healthy soil, and conventional agriculture is something that really generally does not favor a super healthy soil. So a healthy soil that it's rich in symbiotic fungi and the right balance of fungus and bacteria, enhances the flavor potential of the grapes, the health of the vines, and just gives you ultimately a much finer product, end product when you're done.
Somehow I got an image of going to the kitchen and deciding you're going to fix something delicious, and you have to start looking through the cupboard and the refrigerator and figure out what you got to work with. And you hope that you can put something together that's going to be a delicious meal. And somehow that image came to my mind when you start talking about, what's the soil going to give you? What do we have to work with here? You know, you're kind of opening the cupboard doors of Mother Earth and looking in and saying, okay, this is what I got to work with. And then you, like you say, you're starting to pair it with what's the right variety and what are the production practices. Let me go back just to another second, though, too. I'm surprised when I find that I find a wine that tastes, you know, pretty good from areas that I wouldn't think would be producing good wine.
Mm-hmm.
Like Champagne from New Mexico. And, you know, I've tried some certain wines coming from Canada and, you know, wine from Virginia. And, you know, I don't want to be a wine snob and think, well, it can only be, you know, California or France or Italy or Spain. And I just wonder, Randall, someone like you that takes the challenge of what the soil has to offer, could you in theory almost pick different regions and say, okay, Randall, see what you could do with this and, you know, go into Virginia and figure out what might be able to be produced from an area there that's the soil and the climate that could produce a good wine?
Theoretically, one can do it, but ultimately you're always surprised. And until you actually do it, you see it for yourself, you don't know for certain. So basic observation often is a lot more useful than theory. Trying an experiment first, not going crazy. Before you plant 50 acres, start with 50 vines or 10 vines or 2 vines. See how they ripen. See what the characteristics of how the plant appears. Is it healthy? Does it suffer from diseases? So a little observation goes a long way.
So in your picking the areas that, as you have here, how did you find where you're going to have your vineyards?
Well, at the moment, I have just one vineyard singular in mm-hmm. San Juan Bautista, and the process was pretty non-standard. I mean, I looked at a lot of places, and I was looking for certain criteria. One is I'm doing something very special in this site. We're growing some of our grapes, not all of them, but some of our grapes are being grown from seed, which is a non-standard practice. But when you grow grapes from seed, you don't have the benefit of using protective rootstock that protects against phylloxera and other issues. So it needs to be a virgin area that's sort of absent any near neighbors with vineyards. So that's a very specific criterion that I had to look at. I wanted to dry farm. So dry farming requires a certain minimum amount of rainfall. We don't have quite as much rainfall as I would like. And then it also requires a certain amount of water holding capacity in the soil. So these are some of the criteria I was looking for, and I found a place that met as many of these as possible. But really, the other super important criterion is distinctiveness of the site. And there are certain, I mean, this, you know, not all soils are created equal. I wish they were, but they're not. And some soils are inherently more interesting than others. And why are they more interesting? Well, they're more interesting for two reasons. One, they, owing to the structure of the soil and the composition of the soil, they allow for a greater degree of homeostasis in the plant. And a greater degree of homeostasis gives you a more balanced plant and better tasting fruit. And then the other thing seems to be they impart, some of these soils are rich in minerals and seemingly seem to support a larger microbial population. So certain soils are known to be very distinctive. Limestone soils, clay limestone soils in particular, granitic soils, porphyric soils, volcanic soils. All these soils tend to produce a very distinctive flavor characteristic, which is sometimes called terroir, or the sense of place, the wine sense of place. So I was looking for soils, for a place that had some of these very distinctive soils. Other soils are still, you can still grow grapes perfectly well, but they don't impart that same degree of distinctiveness to the wine, but still are useful in their own way.
I was wondering if other crops would present a different flavor characteristics as well. I mean, we are going to just continue to talk about wine and wine grapes.
Yes.
But could you be expecting that other crops could be planted in that soil and, given a chance, would also present something different in flavor characteristics?
Or? Absolutely. This is really virgin territory. I mean, there's certain places that are known for their distinctive flavor. Of course, Walla Walla onions, mm-hmm. Maui onions, you know, certainly the asparagus grown in Spain and the limestone soils there are very special. I think it carries over into produce as well. It hasn't been well studied, but and often commercial practices, you know, if you irrigate, you know, the difference between dry farming, for example, versus irrigated crops tends to have an enormous influence on the flavor that you find. If you can dry farm produce and produce a balanced fruit or vegetable, you're certainly going to have a much more distinctive flavor than something that's been irrigated.
You know, some people won't be able to place exactly where you are that are listening to this podcast, but you're in Central California. You're inland, probably, what, 10 miles, 15 miles from the ocean, just between Monterey and Santa Cruz. Would that place it about right?
Yeah, a little further inland. I mean, Monterey and Santa Cruz are both on the coast, so it's inland. It's just San Juan Bautista is a little southeast of Gilroy and a little maybe 8 or 9 miles west mm-hmm. of Hollister. So just on 156, just off of 101, just a couple miles east of 101.
Well, and it's really close to one of the original missions of the Spanish missions.
Correct.
Did they grow grapes?
Absolutely, they did, and they grew the execrable mission grape. In fact, the vineyard, our vineyard, is located on a road called Mission Vineyard Road, which kind of is somewhat suggestive of a mission and a vineyard. So I think all of the missions and vineyards go together.
Did they plant different varieties as the when the missions were established in the 1700s? Did they find the mission Santa Barbara might have to have different grapes than the mission San Juan Bautista?
I don't think they were that sophisticated at that stage. As I said, the grape, the original grape that was planted was called the mission grape. And there was a mission grape at UC Davis that was the so-called Winkler vine. It was a ginormous vine. I think it was the largest vine cultivated vine in the world. It unfortunately perished, but I think it took up an acre, literally an acre of trellis, a single vine. It was replaced with a new mission vine, and I'm not sure about the. Anyways, but the mission vine was grown from originally from, I guess, either Spain or Portugal, and it seems to be related to the Listón Negro variety. I can't remember whether it's the offspring or the parent, but Mission does not, the grape itself does not have a lot to recommend itself as a table wine. It was used historically to produce a wine called Angelica, and Angelica is made in a very special way. You actually just crush the grape to make grape juice and then add alcohol spirits to it and stop the fermentation, and then it ages for a period of time, and it actually produces a very nice product with enough time. It's just not the table wine that we're accustomed to.
With being only a few miles away from the Mission, it makes me wonder, and maybe you've wondered this as well, how do you suppose your soil is different now than it would have been back when these missions were established?
You know, honestly, I've never given it a moment of thought. Only thing I would suggest is, depending on how the land has been grazed, it's either been compacted to a greater degree or not. I think generally virgin land has a lot more energy and vitality to it than land that has been grazed or overgrazed. But again, depending on the practice, how it's been grazed, is intensively grazed or periodically grazed, and what kind of animals, were they sheep or cows, will have an impact on how the soil, on the soil structure and fertility.
Well, one of the reasons I ask that is that there's a lot of talk about how monocropping and modern farming systems are depleting the soils. And I asked someone else that was down in Southern California near a mission, and they actually had some evidence that the soils actually had been improved because of farming practices and because of crop rotation and because it had been farmed rather than just left barren. And they had a comparison that if they could sneak into the graveyard of the mission and take a spade full of the dirt that had been untouched for over 200 years and kind of compare it to some that had been farmed, in some cases the farmed soil was actually better.
Well, especially if it was farmed organically, I would guess. Mm-hmm. It's a little counterintuitive, or I should mm-hmm. say it's not obvious.
No. No, I know.
But that's interesting.
It's just that they were thinking with the vegetation that you were putting material back into, crop residues going back into the soil over the years and that sort of thing. And so, it's just a lot of things that we still have to figure out. But you're figuring this out, and now you're looking at the soils, you're considering the fact that you're going to be dry farming. So how are you picking the varieties that you believe are going to be the right mix with that soil?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. Obviously, you begin with the known analogous soils. You look at European climates and European soils that are similar. So it seems that the warmer climate grapes seem to do well in San Juan Bautista, but also the ones that are known to have a degree of drought tolerance. So the grapes of southern France seem to be particularly interesting. The Sanso and Grenache in particular seem to really do well. They're drought tolerant, they're wind tolerant. So we look at areas that have similar climate and similar soil. So in our case, the area in France that seems to be very similar is an area called Roussillon, which is not far from the Spanish border in southern France. And the grapes that do well there seem to do exceptionally well in San Juan Bautista.
Now, is that closer to the Mediterranean or closer to the Atlantic side?
Mediterranean, uh-huh. For sure.
That's really interesting. And then you were also talking about dry farming, too. So when you are dry farming, you're going to get more of intensity in the Grenache?
Absolutely. You get more intensity of the fruit. Think of it this way. This is a slightly crass analogy, but or maybe not. I'm not sure if it's crass. But the grapes that do best in dry farming are essentially the ones that are, if you will, brimming with vitality, that left to their own devices, unless they were checked, they would just grow out of control, overly vigorous, overly productive. I think of characters like Pablo Picasso or Henry Miller, that didn't really settle down. There was so much exuberance in their life force that it wasn't until they're in their 80s that they became semi-civilized human beings to deal with. It's kind of the same thing with grapes. Unless these grapes are really throttled back, they just tend to be out of control. So dry farming will have that effect on sort of dampening their exuberant expectations, if you will.
So you're going to be bottling the wine's answer to Picasso, getting that intense.
Maybe more Henry Miller.
Miller. Well, that's that conjures up other images as well. So that's really, really interesting. Now as you're growing these, you get this started and growing the grapes, how are you going to keep track of the microbial level staying as interesting and alive and as you want it to be, to make sure that you're keeping that environment that complements the grape and the somewhat lack of water to create this Henry Miller in a bottle?
The eschewal of herbicides and pesticides, well, herbicides, especially fungicides and herbicides, should keep the flora in check. I'm told the flora actually does change or will change over time, but I think as long as you maintain the characteristics of, you know, the physical qualities that support a healthy microflora, you're going to have the right organism. So it's not so much a matter of inoculating with the right bugs, although maybe we don't even know. This is all in its infancy. You know, the idea of looking at soil microbiology is still really very primitive. Just maintaining healthy conditions, I think, should give us pretty good support for ongoing healthy populations.
Do you think you put a cover crop between the rows of
vines? That's a good question. How much intervention, and what is the appropriate amount of intervention? You know, cover crop. Obviously, if you plant a cover crop, you don't want to plant a monoculture. You want to plant a mixed cover crop. So probably looking at indigenous species in the area would be a good way to go for your cover crop. But you'd want a mixture of legumes and grasses, of course. The other thing that's kind of interesting is the whole idea of adding soil supplements. And one could argue that a soil supplement, however benign, will alter the terroir. But things like compost are particularly helpful for dry farming and enhancing the microbial life of the soil. But then it begs the question, what is in your compost? How do you make your compost? What's the composition, and how do you make it? And do you inoculate it with special organisms? There's a whole new science of composting that is super interesting. And
well, you know, one of the old sciences would be grazing. And what if you had a cover crop could you run sheep in the vineyard?
Sheep are particularly interesting. There's a hypothesis, and I believe it, that European wines, French wines especially, they taste the way they do, and the microbiology of the soil has changed based on the animals that have been grazing, and it's the presence of sheep that makes soils particularly interesting, even more so than cows. So if you have an opportunity to graze sheep in your vineyard, you can enhance some of these soil characteristics pretty dramatically, especially if they've grazed in the same place for, you know, maybe 5,000 years, which seems to be the case in Europe.
That's fascinating. And I understand that sheep are probably going to be better than goats, because goats tend to climb up on stand on their hind legs and leaning against the vines up so that they can nibble vines up high, where sheep will kind of stick to the ground, I understand.
Yeah, you do not want goats in your vineyard, I think, ever.
Yeah. And then if you ever did, just kind of, you've got the wine coming on, and say if you did have sheep, could you envision a time that you might also, you know, have the sheep milk to produce, you know, goat cheese or cheese from sheep, and that could go with your wine? And I'm really reaching for that.
You're reaching. I love the fantasy. I love, you know, apparently the sheep du jour, the sexy sheep du jour, is a so-called baby doll sheep. You know, these are sheep that apparently graze underneath the vine that don't do damage to the vine. And you can actually rent, I'm told, you can rent baby doll sheep. If you can't manage to own your own herd of sheep, you can have a sheep, you know, sheep rental, if you will.
You know, this putting this all together, I'm still stuck with this idea that to me that you're starting with soil and, you know, and producing wine from all of these practices and choosing the variety. And what's the timetable? You've got the vineyard. What's the timetable from now of when you can start having wine available?
Well, it really depends on how ambitious a planting project you have. I mean, theoretically, if you plant a vine, you can start producing fruit maybe 3 years after planting. Where it gets super complicated in our instance is we've planted some vines, you know, conventional vines, but you know, I haven't yet mentioned that we're doing some breeding experiments, and we're actually trying to breed new varieties of grapes as well, and that adds a complicating dimension of another anywhere from 5 to 10 years to the process if you're actually making selections. So from the time you plant a vine, you know, it can be anywhere from 3 to 4 years up to, you know, maybe 10 or 12 years before you actually see any fruit.
How long before I can drink some wine that comes from this vineyard?
Well, theoretically, if you were to come to Santa Cruz, we could do it tomorrow or tonight.
Okay.
But not very much. We made one barrel of white last year and a barrel of red. This year we hope to do somewhat more, but it's still going to be in bottles, not in cases, if you will.
Well, what's the white that you'll be producing there?
We actually make, we have two white grapes, or three white grapes that we're growing in some scale, still pretty modest scale. We've got Grenache Blanc, Grenache Gris. We combine the two to make a single wine. And then we are growing some Furmint, the Hungarian grape called Furmint. We're not quite as successful in getting the Furmint to produce fruit as the Grenache. The Grenache loves it. It feels right at home and produces dramatic wine, scary, frighteningly good wine. The Furmint doesn't set very well, and we're not sure why, but Furmint doesn't seem to take to California, at least not right away.
Well, the wine that you said that was so terrific, if we looked for it, what would it be? What would be the brand, or how would it be referred to in retail?
Well, you could look for it, but you're not going to find it because haven't sold any. But we're going to call the wines that come from this vineyard Popolushum, 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 which is named after the Mutsun term for the area around San Juan Bautista. Which is sometimes translated as the village, but the alternate translation is paradise, and it is a kind of paradise.
So that was a tribe that was originally in the area.
Yeah, it's kind of a linguistic subgrouping of the Ohlone tribe.
Uh huh.
So the Mutsun, they've called themselves the Mutsun.
So, Randall, let's back up, and how did you get yourself into this journey? How did you become a winemaker and have this passion that's carried you through what you're doing, what you've been doing, and what you're going to be doing in the future with this vineyard?
Well, I think if you're kind of a permanent liberal arts major, such as I was, there's kind of a finite number of opportunities. I mean, I think I was exceptionally fortunate to find this métier rather by accident. And I found it by accident wandering into a wine shop. I was working on a philosophy thesis at UC Santa Cruz, getting rather bogged down. And absolutely no concept at all. It's sort of hard to imagine these days, but in the day, kids, when they were in school, actually sort of trusted that the universe was going to find a place for them. And they weren't sweating exactly their career choice as a high school student or an undergrad. They just sort of realize that, or imagine that they would figure it out. And so I imagined somehow I would figure it out, and I did by wandering into this wine store. And the first thing they asked me when I wandered into the store, they said, "Would you like to open a charge account?" I was 20 years old at the time. I said, "Yeah, that sounds good." Anyways, I ended up working in the wine shop, getting indoctrinated into the mysteries of great wine. And the first wines that I experienced were the greatest wines of the world. So I drank at a tender age first growth Bordeaux and classified growth Bordeaux from the 60s and 50s and 40s. It was an incredible opportunity. And I got used to it pretty quick, I have to say.
And then somebody hired you to work?
Well, then at that point, a couple years go by, pages fall off the calendar, and I decide, you know, I think this wine thing is pretty cool, so I'm going to go back to school. And I went to Davis. Miraculously, they allowed me in, having gone to school already once as an undergrad. So my academic career was a little bit like Groundhog Day. So everything I did was twice. Well, it was just twice, I guess, but that was enough. Twice was enough.
Then did you get a job?
Then I got my first job was working for the Smothers Brothers in Santa Cruz.
Oh, that must have been fun.
That was fun. That was great fun. Tiny little winery in Scotts Valley. That was my first job.
And these are the Smothers Brothers?
The Smothers Brothers.
Were they?
Well, it was actually Dick Smothers back then. His brother Tommy joined him a couple of years later.
How was it working for the Smothers Brothers?
Great. Dick is a very nice man. He loved wine. Still loves wine. He actually called me up not too long ago. He said, "Randall, I don't know if you remember me, but this is Dick Smothers." I said, "I do remember you, Dick. Yes, very well." they were kind of my heroes when I was a kid.
Mine too.
Yeah.
They were fun. Where did Bonnie Doon Winery come from?
Well, after I left Smothers, my family helped me buy some property up in the Santa Cruz Mountains in the eponymous area called Bonnie Doon, which is about 10 miles north of Santa Cruz and just about 3 miles inland from Highway 1.
You got noticed for making good wines, but again, I kind of feel like you were also noticed for being out of the box and challenging kind of the conventional wisdom about winemaking.
Well, you know, not just winemaking, in fairness. I mean, I think I was a reasonably clever winemaker, but I think, in fairness, I think I was noticed. I seem to have possibly even better talent for wine marketing than I did for winemaking.
Yeah.
So I accidentally discovered that I had some ability in that regard. And so the wines were successful in part because of the uniqueness of the packaging, the labeling, the particular niche they were in. And this was all intuitive. I had never studied marketing. I just seemed to have some natural affinity for it.
Well, and you'll have...
But it was actually, you know, frankly, it was born out of a fear of failure. I mean, I was so insecure. You know, it's funny, when I was a student at Davis and I met the scions of these noted winemaking families, the Mondavis and the Cakebreads and the Martinis and the Heitzes of the world. It was quite daunting. And maybe it was my insecurity that I just felt I had to work a little harder to succeed.
Well, you're starting a whole new frontier right now. I mean, it seems to me like you're one of those classic, you've had a couple of mountains that you've climbed up one mountain and now you're starting another mountain, but you're really starting literally from the ground floor. And
yes, quite.
with this new program. So when you look ahead at this adventure you're on right now, what are your hopes?
Well, you know, I'm very proud of the wines we've made over the years, and they're great. They're good value. They're interesting. But to be totally honest, I don't know that I've helped to change the world as much as I'd like to. I think when I don't want to make just simply good wine anymore, or even very good wine. I want to make wines that are truly distinctive, that enrich people's experiences to a great extent. And I think like the creation or the discovery of a unique wine, of a distinctive wine, enriches our world in the way that the discovery of a new star or a new species of butterfly or bird, our world is richer for it. So I think those are the wines that matter. And I want to make wines that in the remainder of my career, I want to make wines that matter. I want to make wines that have more meaning, if you will.
Well, it's certainly going to be wines that have more story to them too, because as we've just touched on a little bit here, we're going all the way back to the soil, almost beyond the soil, to the microbial levels in the soil and the climate, the combination, and how it's going to be presenting itself. And I'm still thinking about you're making the equivalent of Picasso in a bottle. And that's an exciting image. And I would imagine that you, as you go down this road, you'll have more disciples. I would imagine people will say, what's he up to? And we'll see somebody pop up here, someone pop up there, and there'll be different elements of your ideas and approach that others will be trying. And it'll spread that way.
Yeah, I mean, but, as with any new discovery, it almost always is the case that there's more than one person who's kind of pursuing this at the same time. And there's just the time itself is right for this approach. I think people are looking for, we live in a foodie culture that appreciates food and wine, but we're also still starved for meaning, and we want our experiences to be more meaningful. I mean, you can go out to all the restaurants you want, and it's great and fun, but many people are looking for a deeper connection. And the point I want to make is that wines of place are just, in my opinion at least, intrinsically more meaningful to people than wines of effort. In other words, if you can make a wine that somehow captures the uniqueness of nature itself and the uniqueness of a place, you're tapping into a much larger intelligence and a much larger system of greater complexity than anything that's a product of just simply a human being's imagination. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, wines that are formulated entirely by the winemaker to reach a certain stylistic objective are only as complex as the winemaker himself or herself, which is to say, not very. But wines of place, are just, partake of nature's complexity, which is, of course, much faster and more awesome, if you will.
And the people that really want to appreciate that probably want to know about it. I mean, you're going to have to figure out how you can get this on a label, I suppose, use your marketing for those that are saying, I want to understand the story behind this wine and what the soils are like and what the climate's like and what the variety and that sort of thing. That challenges your ability to be able to capture that, I suppose, in the stories. But there are people who want to know those stories.
Sure. I mean, some exposition will be required. But, the whole dynamic is changed. In other words, the people will find you. If you've got something truly distinctive, the world will find you, and it's a different dynamic. Rather than trying to chase the world with your story, the world is looking for you. They just don't maybe know it yet, but they're looking for you. So it's a difference between what they call pull marketing versus push marketing. And the quantity that we're going to produce is so limited that it's part of the draws the scarcity as well, of course.
Well, I tell you what, I am looking forward to having some of that new wine and imagining myself maybe standing on the hill there at the Mission in San Juan Bautista and looking off in the direction of your vineyard and having that come back to me, that sense of place that I'm thanks to Randall, we're enjoying a wine that has something really special that's capturing that sense of place. And, you know, we're fortunate to have you doing this, Randall, and, you know, can't wait for it to get to the next stage. And I just want to thank you for being on Farm to Table Talk. But first, I should say, if someone wants to follow you online, do you have a website that people can go
to? Sure. Well, Bonnie Doon has a website. BonnieDoonVineyard.com is our website. I'm on Twitter. Bonnie Doon Vineyard is on Twitter. Just Google Bonnie Doon or my name, and you'll find sort of more information than you ever dreamt.
Yeah, well, existed. I want to dream about it, and I want to drink it too some point in time. But Randall Graham, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.